Well, good morning, brothers, sisters, and young people. It's good to see so many of you here to share this time together. We welcome you here around the table of our Lord. Whether you're joining us in person in the hall or joining us online, we're glad to share this time with you this morning. I'm Brother Sebastian Pitcher. I'll be your chairman here this morning. And serving you with me, we're very pleased to have our brother Paul Yearsley visiting, and he's continuing his series on the greatest mission this morning, and will prepare our minds for the emblems with his words of exhortation that he has prepared. Our brother Paul has chosen for the exhortation this morning the theme of Come See a Man. And as an introduction to his thoughts, we'll take a reading from the Gospel of John, chapter 4, and the first 42 verses. I now invite our brother Paul to lead us to the emblems with his words of exhortation as he reminds us of Christ and encourages us all for the week ahead around his theme, Come See a Man. Thanks, Paul.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. So lovely to be here. I haven't been here before. I love travelling around and seeing familiar faces, but also seeing and meeting new brothers and sisters that are special in our family together. I wanted to start off this morning just telling a story that happened to me or our family about a year ago. I was at work at the fire station. I'm a fireman, as you would have heard on Wednesday night. And I was on duty, and it was in the afternoon, and I was reclining, reading a book in my bedroom, because that's what we get to do sometimes. Sorry. Anyway, I get this phone call from Paula, and it was a very frantic phone call saying, our kitchen is on fire. And I can't put this fire out. I've tried the fire extinguisher. I've tried the fire blanket, but the kitchen is on fire. We can't, and the whole house is filling up with smoke. So this is kind of like a little fire safety talk as well. So what had happened? We had an overseas visitor, one of our relatives or Paula's relatives, come and stay with us. She'd been staying with us for 3 months. This was like the second last day she was with us. She decided to cook chicken wings in a vat of oil. Now, the thing was, she had all this oil in this pot heating up, but she had the lid on. Don't do that. Because what happens is the oil gets heated and the superheated gases reach a temperature that when you remove the lid, oxygen is introduced and it reaches an ignition point and it'll spontaneously blow up into a flame. That's what happened. It went into our kitchen cupboards. So it was hectic at home, and I'm sitting in, and this is the first remote firefighting I think I've ever had to do. So I said to Paul, I go to the back door. Don't go back in the house. Get the hose from the back and try and hit all the cupboards with water. Don't hit the oil pot. Anyway, the fire eventually went out. I think one of the neighbours went and got some sand from a building site nearby. He got smoke inhalation. He was vomiting blood and coughing up all this stuff. And he was in a pretty bad way. But this was our kitchen by the end of it, and my poor coffee machine sitting there. And the whole ground floor of our place was filled with this black, sticky, you know, tar stuff, you know. And this was pretty heavy for me because I'm usually the one on the other side of the fence. So we go to these sort of things and it's so sad to see the destruction that happens through a fire. But we get to put everything out, clean it up a little bit, and they say, so sorry for your loss. We're going home to our nice fire station. I've never been on the other side of this fence. And I think I've got one more photo of Paula chatting up the station officer, talking about what happened. And the thing is with that is that what was interesting after that event, for the next, I came home and I looked at my house, the blackness of our house, and it was we sort of, it's a long story, but we determined that it was still worthwhile living in the house because half the kitchen was still usable, all the bedrooms upstairs were still okay, so but save the hassle of moving. So for 3 months we lived in this sort of state where before it got totally fixed. But in the first 3 days after this happened, I had this uncontrollable feeling. I was just gutted and flat. I'm usually quite an optimistic and positive person, but I just felt flat, and so did Paula. And we started getting cards from people that knew us, cards from our ecclesia, which was so lovely. And then we got one card that really, really rocked me because it was a card from a consortium of sort of middle-aged or youngish brethren that I knew, a lot of them I knew, and I'd had dealings with over the years and been involved in their lives. And I had this card that, you know, sorry, so sorry for your loss, we're thinking of you. And on the card it said, what concerns you concerns him more. That was on the card. It was signed by all his brethren. And Paul and I read this and we just cried. And the reason we cried was because I went down the list of some of these brethren and I knew the trials in some of these brethren's lives, lost kids, traumatic experiences with their young, with their teenage kids. And yet they were choosing to comfort us in our grief, in our trauma, in our loss. And that really, I remember this feeling, and I'm sure you've had this feeling, where someone has done such an amazing act of kindness to you, and it moves you so much, you just want, I just want to pay that forward to somebody else. That's how I felt. Now, we've been talking about this concept about the greatest mission, and it's, remember on Wednesday night, for those of you who were here, we talked about this concept of, what's our ikigai? What's the purpose? What's the reason for our existence on this planet? And we saw how it's to be conformed to the image of his son in Romans 8. So that's obviously about developing to be closer to Jesus at the end than we are at the start. But it's also about conforming to the way Jesus acted when he was on the planet for those 3.5 years of his ministry, where he was desperate to connect with anybody, to sow a seed, to be a light. To fish for men. To impact someone, to set them free. To give them life forever. That was his mission. And we talked about how the Bible is constantly emphasizing this concept in metaphors so that we get the point that we need to follow Christ in this, not just in organized activities, but I'm primarily talking about the day, the moment we walk out our door, we've got to be about our Father's business. And we need to be praying for opportunities to contact people and have a conversation. And there's a great responsibility about that, yes. But if we're only doing it because we've just been responsible, it's far less powerful than when we're motivated by what Christ has done for us and what the gospel really means to you and me in here. So that when we walk out that door, I want to show people, I want to give people what it means to me. I want them to feel the same thing. That's what it's about. And what I love about, I just want to show you this. That's our ikigai. I love this passage in 1 Peter. It says, you know what? You and I have tasted. We have tasted and really enjoyed that the Lord is gracious. To you who believe, he is precious. He is precious. But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people. You're the most privileged people. You and I are the most privileged people on the planet. We sit here with all these benefits of knowledge, of the gift of life, and all the other things that we could talk about. He says, and the reason we've been given that, we're his special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Because you've now have obtained mercy. Isn't that a powerful message of paying it forward? But we will never pay it forward if we don't fully appreciate the enormity of what's been done for us. And I think our life's journey is to grow every day in appreciation and gratitude and feel it in ourselves before we, and as we pass it on. And this is kind of where I want to go with this story, this beautiful story in John 4 this morning, the woman at the well. The first thing we want to have a look at, I just want to just track what's happening here because, and I've got the New King James Version, and this interaction with the woman at the well, we read in John 4 and verse 5 and 6 that it's at this Jacob's well at Sychar. And in my Bible at least, in the margin where it talks about how Jacob gave his son, it's near a plot of land that Jacob gave his son Joseph. There's a reference to Joshua 24 and verse 32. And it's basically in the area of Shechem. And Shechem is this incredible place where you have these two mountains, which you probably know about, Mount Gerizim, the Mount Blessing, and Mount Ebal, the Mountain of Cursing. And it's so significant, and Sychar's in this area of Shechem. It's such a significant place because you think about the history of that place. What happened there? Well, Moses gave this incredible speech to the people of Israel, his last words. And you might remember them in Deuteronomy 27 to 30, all through that section, you can read it, where he's saying, I'm laying before you, you can have all these blessings. But if you reject me, you're going to have all these cursings. And he's screaming at the people of Israel as this old man just about to die, saying, remember these words? Choose life. That's what he says. And then Moses departs the scene and Joshua goes through all his life and all his experiences, and he comes to the end of his life and his last words are basically the same thing. In Joshua 24, he goes, when you read Joshua 24, he goes through everything that God had done for that people. How in their evil, idol-worshipping existence in Egypt, God still loved them and took them out of Egypt to the promised land. And he said, and you read Joshua 24, there's this emphasis on how much God gave. He gave, he gave, he did, he gave. And they didn't deserve it. And Joshua was trying to inspire his people to understand the enormity of that. And he says, choose, make a choice. And you remember he says, for me and my house, I'm going to choose the Lord. This is the history of this place. And in comes Jesus. And in my version here, in the New King James, about 1,500 years later or so, in verse 4, my version says, but he needed to go through Samaria. And the Greek word, is the idea of he must or it was necessary. There was a deliberate intention by Jesus to actually go there to this specific well to obviously target this woman. And we're told in verse 6, what hour of the day was it? It was the sixth hour. I just want you to remember that. We'll talk about that right at the end. In that it's in the sixth hour of the day or midday, in the heat of the day, and we're told that Jesus was weary. And he comes here in the heat of the day and he sits by the well and waits for this specific interaction with a woman. This is a Samaritan woman. Now let's pause there for a minute and think about all the reasons why someone, just a normal person, would not ever want to interact with a Samaritan woman or this woman. Well, first of all, think about the history of the Samaritans and the Jews. I mean, in verse 9, when the woman says to Jesus, she's so surprised because she says at the end of verse 9, she goes, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings. They hated each other's guts. They were enemies. They were the Samaritans were this mixed race, which were part Jewish and had intermarried with the Assyrians in this sort of swap. And so this mixed race grew up amongst the other Jewish people, and they became bitter enemies and hated each other. They hated these Samaritans because they were a mixed religion. There was paganism at their core, but they still accepted the books of Moses. You think about the long history of hostility and hatred that you know about. At the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, there was always this conflict. And then right through to the times of Jesus, they were publicly cursed in synagogues. You couldn't be if you were a Samaritan, you couldn't be a witness in a Jewish court. And it was the ultimate insult if you called a Jew, you were just a Samaritan. Remember in John 8, the Jews mocked Jesus and he said, "You are a Samaritan and have a demon." It was the ultimate insult. That's how much there was this hatred between the two. So why on earth would you talk to a Samaritan, number one? Number two, it's a woman. A man's talking to a woman, and the culture back there was that just didn't happen. And the disciples say that. Did you notice that in verse 27, it says the disciples come back after getting stuff, and it says they marvel that he talked with a woman. Yet no one said, "What do you seek?" or "Why are you talking with her?" So this is number two, the second reason. And the third reason is that Jesus knew about a messed up, dysfunctional life. In verse 16, we read about how he tells her deliberately to go get a husband to draw out the story about her life, how that she had five husbands and the sixth one was like this de facto. And you think about that for a minute, where she's been through five and into a sixth relationship and she's the common denominator. And we don't really know about all the details about those relationships. Some of them may have died, I don't know. But there seems to be the dysfunctionality, and she's the common denominator of it all. This unfortunate, poor woman with terrible relationships. Immoral. And psyche, interestingly enough, means drunken. Possibly, it's like almost metaphorical for her life. The drunken state of her life. So there's those three things: the messed up dysfunctionality of her life, being a Samaritan who was hated, and being a woman. And here's Jesus in his compassion and his grace, despite who she is, talking to her. And you know what I love? Remember on Wednesday night, for those of you who were here, we said, sometimes when we're interacting with people, we just need to have one little phrase, one little seed, one little lure. And I think I told you that story. I didn't tell you it properly on Wednesday night, because I said that lady in the pathology ward, when she was doing the blood, she said, "I'm going off to lunch to read my book." She didn't say that. She said, "I'm going to read my favourite book." And that prompted, and from that, as I said on Wednesday night, a baptism eventuated about a year later on that phrase. Look what Jesus says. He just says, "Give me a drink." Isn't that cool? Jesus started a conversation with a little phrase, "Give me a drink." It opened up so much. And then, as we know, in verse 10, he talks about giving this woman the offer of living water. And he if you haven't already highlighted this in your Bible, I think it's so important. He says, "If you knew the gift of God." This living water is the gift, and he offers that to this woman. And Jesus says in verse 13 and 14, You know what happens to you when you get the gift of this living water? Read verse 13 and 14 with me again. It says, whoever drinks of this water will thirst again, but whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him, he will never thirst, but the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life. Do you know what that means? Like the Greek word for springing up means to leap out of you. And that's what living water is designed to do in us. It's designed to be so meaningful, so impactful, so motivational that it just drives out of us. And so we just can't but help pay it forward. And that's exactly, I love this story, the imagery of this story, because that's exactly what happens with this woman when she realizes what Jesus has done for her. In verse 28 and 29, it says that she leaves a water pot. And what does it say? She goes her way into the city and said to the man, and I highlight this phrase. This should be our mantra in life. Come see a man. Come see a man who told me all things I ever did. And it's sort of repeated in verse 39 at the end. He told me all things I ever did. And I think when we read that statement, we've got to read between the lines where, well, the way I read it anyway is that she's saying to these men, come see a man who cast aside all the hate and he loves me. He knows all my failures, my weaknesses, my flaws, the dysfunctionality of my life. He knows the real me, warts and all. And yet when he was weary, he gives me this gift. This gift of living water, this grace that I might drink deeply of it. And she was so motivated to tell these people to say, come and see this man. And as we know, as a result, in verse 39 and 41, many believed because of it. I don't want to turn this section up. You know this passage in Romans 5. And I think there's so many allusions to this story. Jesus Christ died at the right time, or in due time. It was a deliberate, planned moment for you and me. I don't care who we are or what we think of ourselves. We are all, to some degree, in a dysfunctional, unlovable state. It calls us in Romans 5 ungodly, we're sinners, we're enemies. And he says, I'm going to give you living water. And he says in verse 5 in Romans 5, the love has been poured out into our hearts. And all through that chapter, you have this emphasis on grace. If you've done that exercise of going through Romans 5 and colouring in the amount of times it talks about the gift, the free gift, the gift, it's exactly the same as what we've been told here in John 4. And how there's this abundance of grace. You know what I think happens sometimes? I mean, I don't know, put your hand up if you've murdered someone lately. You've robbed the Commonwealth Bank. No one? So we start thinking, oh, I'm not quite that bad. I'm not really that bad a guy or a girl. I'm telling you now that if an angel appeared to us and miraculously put a big screen up on the wall of all the embarrassing moments of our life when we were so far removed from been conformed in the image of Christ, we would soon get a pretty real picture of who we are. Where we were dishonest or lacked integrity, we were rude with a short fuse. We neglected to help when we knew we should have helped someone. We were on the phone or computer checking out sites that we know that are inappropriate and wrong. When we pointed the fingers of others to take the heat off ourselves, well, we should have had a good look inside, right inside here. When we put on this facade of spirituality, when we're in the spotlight on these platforms and stuff like that, but in the real darkness of our life, we're someone completely different. What a joke that would show. And what about if you had all the little interactions of your life and a phrase came up about the exact thought or the emotions you felt in those situations, like jealousy, hatred, arrogance, pride, selfishness, inappropriate lust. Soon get a real picture of how dysfunctional and inconsistent our lives really are, where our spirituality is up and down. That's our life. And we live with consequences sometimes of those bad things and decisions, with mistakes we've made. We can't change our past like that woman. And I think if we're ever going to feel the enormity of what's happened to us, we've got to firstly understand how we're more like the dysfunctional Samaritan woman than we often care to admit. And the level of gratitude, I think, increases the more we are willing to look in the mirror and be honest. There's a brother, a very close friend of mine, that had an affair when he was in his younger years. And he was away from the meeting for a number of years, and he returned. He was a broken man. And I hear him give talks on grace. And I look into his eyes and I see a man that has been deeply impacted and knows and feels the enormity of the grace that God has offered to him. So this woman invites us into her world and invites us to follow her and say to as many people as we can, wherever we get an opportunity. And on Wednesday night, we're going to talk about just being organic. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to stand on the, you know, in the middle of, you know, what is it, Rundle Mall and on a milk crate and yell stuff. If you want to do that, go for it. But it's just these organic interactions each day. And so this woman invites us to say that, come see a man. That's what the living water does. It's not just absorb, it's given out. I just want you to, I'm just going to come across to Isaiah 12 for a minute, and then we're going to finish in Revelation. But there's a pretty similar theme that this pattern continues into the future. When you think about the enormity of Israel's sins, how frustrated God is with his people. Isaiah 11 and Isaiah 12. Isaiah 11 is about the concept of how the outcasts of Israel are going to return in the future. And a remnant of his people are going to come back to him. After all this time, God has hung with them and promised them that he would never forsake them and always be waiting for them. And a remnant would return. But I want you to read with me what Isaiah 12 says about this, about the nation of Israel. Isaiah 12 says, in that day you will say, O Lord, I will praise you. Though you were angry with me, your anger is turned away and you comfort me. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid, for Yah, the Lord, is my strength and song. He has also become my salvation. This is his people singing this. This is their heart song. This is their life song. Now, as they realize the enormity of their journey in the history of their nation. But look what it says next in verse 3. It says, as a result of that, therefore with joy will you draw water from the wells of salvation. And in that day you will say, praise the Lord, call upon his name, declare his deeds among the peoples, make mention that his name is exalted, sing to the Lord, for he has done excellent things. This is known in all the earth. Cry out and shout, O inhabitant of Zion, for great is the Holy One of Israel in midst. Isn't that powerful? That's the same pattern where the enormity of what God has done for Israel rocks them to the point where they realize they've drawn those waters, those living waters out again, the grace that God has given to them for eternity. And they can't but declare his deeds amongst the nations. I'll be walking around the nations of the world at that time in the kingdom age going, look what God did with us. And he's doing that with you now. Come see this man. Come honor the king, the Messiah that we finally recognize. Let's have a look at one more pattern in Revelation. We'll finish in this. Revelation. There's probably a few passages in Revelation we could pick out. I just want to pick out two. Revelation 21. Revelation 21 and verse 6. And he said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things. I'll be his God and he shall be my son. He's giving this water freely, not in the sense that there's no conditions or responsibility that we have. It's free in the sense that you and I could never have earned this. We never deserve this. But he's giving you this deep, rich, living water to draw from. And this is the saints that have been able to experience this. And then jump across to chapter 22. You know, chapter 22 is beautiful. It talks about this river of life and how the nations are going to be healed in the future. But let's read verse, let's tie it in. Verse 13, he says, I am the Alpha and the Omega, beginning and the end, the first and the last. Blessed are those who do his commandments, that they may have the right to the tree of life, may enter the gates into the city. Just jump down to verse 16. I, Jesus, as he concludes this book of Revelation, this amazing book, I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify to you these things in the ecclesias. I am the root and the offspring of David, the bright and the morning star. But look what he says next. Spirit and the bride say, come. Let him who hears say, come. So this, the saints, the bride of Christ, the ones that really hear, that's the way I interpret this, the ones who are really hearing, remember in the letters of the seven ecclesias, he that hath an ear, let him hear. If you're hearing, we can all sit here, but are we really hearing? The true saints, the ones that hear, they're saying, come, come see this man. Let him who thirsts come. Who desires, let him take the water of life freely. That's the mantra of Bride of Christ, that they, in their lives, they say, come see this man and honor him. So for now, we do honour this man. And I want you to think about the day Jesus was crucified and exhibited in history. This is all about the cost. We reap all these benefits, but there was this cost of living water that we enjoy. When you read the story of the crucifixion, there's all these echoes of John 4 in that event. You think about it. He's the greater than Joshua in his exhibition saying, look at what God's done for you. Choose life. Choose, make the choice. He's crucified between two thieves, one that was blessing him, one that was cursing him, the two mountains. And you remember on the sixth hour of the day for 3 hours it went black. I believe God's emotions were poured out in that event. Darkness for 3 hours, this supernatural event. And as he hung there in his weariness and his thirst, he gave the greatest gift to humanity. You and me, the opportunity to drink of living waters. We have to see him as precious. And he's asking us to respond, to leave our water pot and go and let that living water spring out of us and say to people, come see this man. Because he told me everything I ever did. Thanks.